From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, as Iraqi militants edge closer to Baghdad, we'll look at who they are and what they want.
The more that this fight becomes framed as a sectarian one, the more that ISIL gains over the long run.
Also today, Britain says it's ready to reopen an embassy in Iran, just as US officials talk to the Iranians about Iraq. We'll hear from our correspondents in London and Vienna. A new exhibit of South African artwork in Washington by an artist's collective explores the HIV/AIDS experience.
The first time we came in here, saw people crying because of our work. That makes me proud.
And does a government arts minister have to have a deep appreciation of the arts? That's all ahead on today's FSN Reports after our summary of the main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The U.S. government says it has captured the suspected ringleader of the 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. Ahmed Abu Katala is accused of killing the U.S. ambassador to Libya and three others in the attack. According to U.S. Rear Admiral John Kirby, Katala is now being held in U.S. custody outside Libya. He said there were no civilian casualties and all U.S. troops involved in the raid have safely departed the country. President Obama, who has been under fire for his administration's handling of the attack, told reporters Katala's arrest sends a clear message.
No matter how long it takes, we will find those responsible and we will bring them to justice. And that's a message I sent the day after it happened. And regardless of how long it takes, we will find you. I want to make sure that everybody around the world hears that message very clearly.
Fighting continues in Iraq between government forces and Sunni insurgents who continue to make gains. At least 44 people have reportedly died after clashes at a police station in the city of Baquba outside Baghdad. U.S. President Barack Obama has authorized the deployment of 275 military personnel in and around Iraq to help restore peace. Mr. Obama has vowed to keep the troops out of combat. Instead, they will be used to provide support and security for the American embassy in Baghdad. Here's State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki.
These are military are there for the security of the embassy. That's what their focus is. That's the role they're playing. This is linked to the announcement we made on Sunday about the relocation of some of our staff and the fact that some would be coming in to help the security there.
Almost $24 billion U.S. dollars worth of commercial deals have been signed between the U.K. and China during the Chinese premier's three-day visit to Britain. The British prime minister says he sees these new agreements as strengthening links between the two countries. Natalie Powell has more from London.
The UK Prime Minister welcomed the deals, saying the UK is the most popular destination in Europe for Chinese investment, adding that in the last 18 months there has been more Chinese investment into the UK than in the past 30 years. It's the first official visit by a Chinese leader in over 3 years to the UK, and Mr. Li was given an audience with the Queen, something that's usually reserved for heads of state. Elsewhere, oil giant BP is also expected to strike a deal, this time with the China National Offshore Oil Corporation to supply the Chinese firm with liquefied natural gas.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. President Barack Obama says the world's oceans, the source of food and economic growth for billions, must be protected. The White House has announced a plan to significantly expand protections for a huge swath of the Pacific Ocean south and west of Hawaii. Priscilla Huff reports.
The expansion of the Pacific Remote Islands Marine National Monument will protect almost 800,000 square miles. U.S. President Barack Obama says the protection of the islands, reefs, and atolls is in everyone's best interest.
I'm going to use my authority as president to protect some of our most precious marine landscapes, just like we do for mountains and rivers and forests. These are just a few of the steps the United States is taking to keep our oceans strong and healthy.
As international leaders met at the U.S. State Department to discuss marine pollution and the acidification of the oceans, the White House announced steps at home to sustain fishing and to protect water habitats as well. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
And the United Nations Security Council unanimously adopted two resolutions proposed by the U.S., which review the measures against the Taliban and related terrorist groups that threaten international peace and security. Patrice Howard reports from UN headquarters in New York.
The updated resolutions address concerns about the changing nature of the threat posed by these terrorist groups, whether in the way they use new technology, the methods in which they attract international recruits, or their abuse of nonprofit organizations for financial gain. The Council requests that member states continue to monitor financial exchanges, travel, and weapons transfers among these flagged terrorist groups. The resolution also tasks the monitoring team to consult with the committee or member states when identifying individuals or entities that should be added or removed from the sanctions list. Patrice Howard, New York.
For the rest of the day's news, you can follow us on Twitter at Feature Story. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. Today on the program, we take an extensive look at events in Iraq and the rapidly developing relationship between Western governments and Iran. Starting in Iraq, the Sunni militants who stunned the world last week by taking the cities of Mosul and Tikrit were fighting Iraqi forces today in Bakuba, less than 40 miles from the capital Baghdad. At one point, they controlled part of Bakuba before Iraqi forces pushed them back. The Obama administration disclosed last night that for the first time since December 2011, U.S. troops are back in Iraq. 275 military personnel deployed in the capital Baghdad to provide support and assistance for the U.S. embassy there. The rapidly shifting environment in Iraq is placing an enormous focus on the Sunni militant group that has taken territory and was accused yesterday by the US of terrorizing, murdering and assassinating. Brian Fishman knows more about them than virtually anyone in Washington. He's a counter-terrorism analyst with the New America Foundation and has been widely hailed for rigorously following the activities of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, also known as ISIL. He spoke to the PBS NewsHour's Gwen Ifill.
Well, ISIL is the modern incarnation of the organization that was originally founded in Iraq by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. That began in the early days after the U.S. Occupation of Iraq. It turned into al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2004, was later, after Zarqawi's death in October of 2006, an entity called the Islamic State of Iraq was declared. And that was the first time that this organization really wanted to attempt to govern large areas in Iraq.
The name we keep hearing is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Tell us about him.
Well, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was born in Samarra, which is a town just north of Baghdad. He's sort of exalted in sort of an interesting way by the jihadis that support him. They tell this rags-to-riches story of a very poor boy that wound up going to study perhaps for a doctorate at a university in Baghdad, studying Islamic theology and poetry. We know for a fact that he was imprisoned in a U.S. facility during the insurgency back in 2005. Exactly when he was released and the conditions under the circumstances of that release are not exactly clear, but what is clear is that he was radicalized in prison and then rose through the ranks of the ISI and then the ISIL. And he's somebody that, unlike other jihadi leaders, very much is willing to stay out of the limelight. He seems very focused on sort of the practical application of force and the movement towards his strategic objectives. That doesn't mean that the ISIL has not been brutal. It has been extraordinarily brutal. But I think it is notable that al-Baghdadi, as opposed to somebody like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi historically, is very, very focused on his long-term objectives. And he does seem to me to be more flexible in terms of how he applies his understanding of Islamic law in various places. So you see ISIL taking a much harsher approach in Syria than it has in Iraq, for example, where it has been able to rebuild some relationships with tribal groups and other Sunni militant organizations that it had alienated previously.
Brian Fishman of the New America Foundation talking there to Gwen Ifill on the PBS NewsHour. The 275 military personnel deployed by President Obama in Iraq have been sent in a non-combat mode. Their aim to provide support and assistance to U.S. embassy personnel who are being relocated temporarily from the sprawling complex in the Green Zone, the largest U.S. embassy anywhere in the world. So how will they operate and what will they do? Lord Alan West is a former Chief of Defence Intelligence for the British government.
Quite clearly, they don't want to get involved, I think very sensibly, with large numbers of troops on the ground. They want to somehow bolster the Iraqi regime. And I'm sure, I'd be very surprised if they didn't start using air and drone strikes. And of course, if they put in special forces, those people can spot and mark for the use of the weapons that those things fire, as well as satellites and UAVs and things like that.
Just let's talk about special forces in a little more detail. In anybody's book, that does mean troops being put onto the ground. What would their focus be? How could a small number help to defeat ISIS? Isn't it already perhaps too little too late?
Well, I think the focus for them would be, if they went in, would be to give advice to the Iraqis about how to counter the ISIS forces, but primarily to make sure they could target and control the vast amount of weaponry that can come in via the U.S. carrier's aircraft, the drone aircraft, and also tactical land attack missiles, which can also be used if the target's worthy of it.
Alan West, the former Chief of Defence Intelligence for the British government, talking there to Lisa Aziz of Britain's LBC Radio. As the situation in Iraq intensifies, the British government announced today that it will reopen its embassy in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Bilateral ties have thawed recently, 3 years after attacks on the British embassy in Iran led to the suspension of full diplomatic relations. Britain's moves to improve its relationship with Iran come as the West engages with Tehran on the unfolding crisis in Iraq, as FSN's Ollie Barrett reports from our London bureau.
Iran is not quite flavour of the month yet, according to UK Foreign Secretary William Hague, but he says creating an environment where talks with Iran on Iraq and other matters can take place is important.
There is no softening of any of our policies in relation to Iran. We look to Iran to seize support for sectarian groups elsewhere in the Middle East, to reach a successful conclusion to nuclear negotiations. But I do believe it is important to discuss such issues with Iran, and we need the ability to do so.
The reopening of Britain's embassy in Tehran is the latest step in improving relations since the election of President Hassan Rouhani. The two countries had already appointed chargé d'affaires to each other last year amid nuclear talks between Iran and the West. But at Westminster, Labour Shadow Foreign Secretary Douglas Alexander is pushing his counterpart to ensure the current Iraq crisis can be eased by Iran and improved diplomatic ties between the two countries.
Iran surely has a choice to make between being a stabilising or destabilising force in an already volatile region. So can the Foreign Secretary set out his thinking on how engagement with Iran on tackling ISIL in Iraq could be used to help encourage a change of approach from Iran in relation to the conflict in Syria more broadly?
We would welcome and we will press for a wider change in the foreign policy of Iran. Nuclear negotiations are taking place now. It is important that those issues are resolved between Iran and the rest of the international community. But Iran does have the capability to play a more positive role across the region.
Tens of thousands of Iranians live in Britain, and for them the improvement of diplomatic ties means they'll be able to take advantage again of visa and consulate services currently not available. William Hague says the UK's embassy in Tehran will reopen as soon as practical arrangements can be taken care of. Ollie Barrett, London.
And now to Vienna, where US officials held talks on Iraq with Iranian negotiators on the sidelines of a meeting that was supposed to be all about Tehran's nuclear program. FSN's Europe correspondent Sandra Gutman is there. Sandra, we know the two sides discussed Iraq last night after Secretary of State John Kerry indicated it might be possible for the US and Tehran to work together on Iraq. Was there more talk about it today?
Well, we've not had any reports today that there was a repeat of the casual chat we know happened on the margins of these nuclear talks yesterday on the first day of this fifth round of nuclear negotiations with Iran. But we do know that there is still mutual concern from all sides about violence in Iraq and how the ISIS militants are really gaining territory there. We know that before joining these talks here in Vienna, that Washington officials hinted these conversations on Iraq could be had with Iran. But now it's all about getting through these technical discussions on reaching this nuclear deal. Having said that, the situation in Iraq appears to be worsening. So perhaps during the course of this week, while nuclear talks continue, that these conversations on Iraq aren't over yet.
And how might the Iraq situation impact the nuclear talks? Could it create a conducive background for diplomacy on that issue?
Well, I think everyone is trying very hard to separate these issues from each other. Remember, these nuclear negotiations are, while in one sense very detailed and very technical, they're also highly politically sensitive, and it has to do with establishing trust. The U.S. and its Western allies want to make sure that Iran is stripped of its ability to develop a nuclear weapon, despite Tehran's assurances that it doesn't want to develop one. So Iran and the West aren't about to become friends over the slight possibility of working together in Iraq. And I think that while they do have this common interest in defeating the ISIS militia in Iraq from making further gains, both are very wary of each other in meddling in Iraq and their possible lasting legacy in the country if they intervene in a major way. So it's an issue the two are engaging on, which could be seen as positive, but again, it's very complicated. And I think many see this enhanced cooperation in Iraq as possibly harming the political standoff that is really underpinning these nuclear negotiations.
FSN's Sandra Gutman on the line from Vienna. This is FSN Reports, and we turn our attention for the rest of the programme to the world of the arts. Painting with beads, that's how the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. describes the art of a group of South African women who have developed a new take on an old tradition. The Ubukle Collective all live and work together on a former sugar plantation near Durban, and they create fabric panels covered with glass beads, many of which reflect their own sufferings after having lost friends and relatives to HIV/AIDS. Now, an exhibition of their work has made it all the way to the US Capitol, along with some of the women themselves. FSN's Lorna Shaddock went to meet them.
I just couldn't believe that things of that quality were being done with beads.
Just one reaction from a visitor to the work of the Ubukle women of South Africa. Black fabric covered in tiny coloured glass beads, intricately hand-sewn into swirling patterns, shapes and pictures, covers the walls of the Smithsonian's Anacostia Community Museum in Washington, D.C., glinting and glistening in the low light. These are the Ndwango, panels depicting cattle, cherry blossom, rivers, stars, and in the centre of the room, a dazzling seven-panelled piece called the African Crucifixion, showing Christ on the cross. Bev Gibson co-founded the Ubukle Collective in 1999. She says it came about as a way for local women to be financially independent.
They could use traditional skills that they'd learned from their mothers or grandmothers to earn an income and to create a product of excellence, which would then reach the marketplace without any exploitation.
That excellence comes in part from the powerful stories behind the artwork. Many of the artists have battled with poverty, abuse and illness. Indeed, since 2006, the Ubukle community has lost five artists to HIV and AIDS. So many of the panels function as memorials to sisters who've been lost. One of the artists, Andile Ntobela, explains.
I have two sisters left us. They passed away. But all the time when I'm doing my beadwork, I used to remember them and I miss them. So when we're sitting doing our thing, I'm feeling it.
Sandile's family couldn't afford to keep sending her to school when she was younger, something she says she used to be ashamed about.
They used to tell me that if you didn't go to school, you're nothing. But now I'm the one who's good because my work made me proud of myself. I put food at the table for my children. They go to school, and I'm famous.
Following the exhibition here in Washington, D.C., the group have commissions for the next 2 years. Bev Gibson says that will help the community build for the future.
With the confidence that this exhibition at the Anacostia Museum has given us, we are now including more women into a guild where they are being taught. But they are being taught the beading of necklaces, making the little purses, the jewellery part of it.
That guild will hopefully involve the 15 children the women care for, many of whose parents died from AIDS. The issues that underpin the Buccleuch work are relevant in DC too, says the museum's director of education, Paul Perry.
You have this idea of economic improvement, also the idea of HIV and AIDS. There's several AIDS clinics in this community. The African-American community is one of the hardest hit populations for AIDS. So you have the color connection, you have the AIDS connection, and you have the economic disparity connection.
Meanwhile, Sandile says seeing her work on display had as much of an impact on her as it did on the Americans who visited.
The first time we came in here, saw people crying because of our work. That makes me proud. I cry when I came here because I never see my work with the beautiful place like this before. And I cried because I saw the other pieces for my sisters passed away. And I can feel that my sister staying here around us. They are watching our work. So everything, it's marvelous.
Small beads shimmering in a darkened room, but imbued with more power than you might think. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, and it's time for another contribution from Peter Aspden, the arts correspondent of the Financial Times, whose essays appear on our programme regularly. This week, the appointment of a new Minister for Arts and Culture within the British government, Sajid Javid. Artistically, he's a man of the people, but the FT's Peter Aspden isn't entirely sure that's a good thing.
These are choppy times for what used to be called, without any recourse to air-mimed quotation marks, the high arts. The UK's new culture secretary, Sajid Javid, was in confessional mode when he made his first keynote speech in the job recently. He was, he confessed, a Star Trek fan. He loved, he confessed, the music of U2. He was proud, he confessed most sensationally of all, to have a picture of Baroness Thatcher on his office wall. There followed a range of fashionably eclectic references to prove that he genuinely believed in multi-layered multiculture, Bollywood, Haydn, Virginia Woolf. But we know where his sympathies lie. "I want you to make what you do accessible to everyone," was his message to the creative community, in something of the demotic spirit that one can imagine coming from Javid's hero, Jean-Luc Picard. The USS Enterprise captain's near namesake, Jean-Luc Godard, once expressed a very different view. "One of the most striking signs of the decay of art is when we see its separate forms jumbled together," he said, in a spirit of zero tolerance towards the kind of cultural mashup that wins such widespread approval today. What do we do, in all seriousness, with art that is proudly inaccessible? That wears its integrity with such determination that it defies the gaze of the casually interested onlooker? How do we justify work that goes beyond the homilies of interplanetary détente or the coruscating rock riff? Does it indeed need any justification at all? In Life May Be, a new film which receives its world premiere at the Edinburgh International Film Festival next Saturday, the signs are promising, or ominous, according to point of view, right from the start. There's that portentous title, and then the opening credits highlighting the shamelessly titled Highbrow Productions, a free curatorial digital arts platform founded by Don Boyd, the guiding spirit behind such uncompromising works as Scum, Aria and War Requiem. The film is written and directed by two figures of immaculate cultural provenance. Mark Cousins is a critic and filmmaker who made the masterly documentary The Story of Film, An Odyssey, a series that was assembled with such imagination and erudition that it managed to make light of its title's Homeric aspirations. Mania Akbari is the Iranian director who came to prominence in the work of her compatriot mentor Abbas Kiarostami, and who has herself directed a succession of terse commentaries on the plight of relationships in her native country. Neither artist is likely to be standing next to Captain Picard on the bridge, rooting guilelessly for galactic peace. Not because they don't believe in it, but out of an innate scepticism towards the banal answering of obvious questions. Life May Be is not a film for everyone. It plays with form, unravelling as a series of film letters between the two directors, eloquent in both their written exchanges and in their quiet, ravishing images. It's poetic, elusive, demanding. It's sure to prompt, on its release, some withering responses from those who will find it willfully self-indulgent. Cousins started the exchange, having been asked to write an essay on Akbari, whose work he had admired. "But I try to avoid writing about people. I prefer to write to them," he tells me in a telephone conversation, "even when they're dead." He has also written to Sergei Eisenstein, Orson Welles, and John Ford. In his first missive, he compared Akbari to Virginia Woolf. To his amazement, he says, Akbari wrote back. It was the idea of an Iranian film critic that the two should commit their exchanges to film. At no stage, says Cousins, did the two meet, nor have they since the film's completion. "It was so exciting, we were egging each other on, trying to stretch each other," he says. I tell him I worry about the future of films such as this, intensely personal, oniric works that don't have a hope of capturing anything but a cult following, but he brushes my concerns aside. Right from cinema's first days, he says, the art form was a mixture of poetry and prose, both a window and a mirror. Although the potential rewards in commercial cinema have become an overwhelming force for cultural conservatism, the poetry won't go away, he says. Technology means that films such as Life May Be can be made for zero money, just out of love for cinema. He declares himself to be optimistic. There's such amazing stuff out there, really pushing the boundaries, from Thailand, the Philippines, Hungary, Romania. He stops only because we both know that he is about to run through most of the nations of the world. Watching the film, I was intrigued by a tattoo on Cousins' arm, consisting simply of the name Foro. I found out, during the course of his conversation with Akbari, that this was in tribute to the Iranian poet and film director Foro Farrokhzad, who worked in the 1950s and 60s and who died in a car accident at the age of 32 in 1967. I didn't know her work and have, since seeing the film, immersed myself in her beautiful, melancholy writings. And isn't this the point of the most ambitious art, that it seeks to open doors and make lateral connections with the work of other artists, continually stretching us and taking us to places we would not have imagined? Farrokhzad wrote about the tyranny of convention in one of her most celebrated poems, Let Us Believe in the Beginning of the Cold Season. I will seek refuge from the mob of finite measured forms in the sensitive planes of expanse. That's probably not where you will meet Sajid Javid anytime soon, too busy setting Klingon poetry to Bono's catchiest melodies. Let's agree with him that art needs to be for everyone, but that it should, on occasion, ask us to reach up to it, rather than bending down to make it too easy. Please make it so.
Peter Aspden, arts correspondent of the Financial Times. You can read his arts coverage in the newspaper and on its website at ft.com. And that's FSN Reports for today. Don't forget to let us know what you think of the programme. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can also interact with us on Twitter. We are there at Feature Story. I'm Simon Marks in Washington for everyone with FSN everywhere. Thanks for listening. Have a great evening. Goodbye.